Thank you so much for inviting me here to talk to you today. One of the main aims of our group is about raising awareness of the refugee crisis. And so doing talks like this is really part of what we're about. I really hope that what I've chosen to talk about will be of interest to you and it will touch you. I could talk for a long time on this subject, but I'm going to try and narrow it down. I am going to talk to you about the refugees generally and about what we've been doing locally, but I'm also going to talk to you about my own journey. I really believe that this is what God wants me to do right now, and he's been leading me on this journey every step of the way. So it all started back in September 2015. Most of you will remember this photograph. It's a photograph of a little boy called Alan Curdy. And it was in the newspapers, and I think it was the first time that many of us woke up to the crisis that was unfolding, actually not very far from our shores. His body was washed up on a beach in Turkey. His parents were trying to cross from Turkey to the island of Kos, and obviously the journey was not successful for them. At the time, I was very involved in the leadership of All Saints Church in Marlow, where I've been a member for quite a few years. But I remember sitting and talking to our vicar, Dave Bull, having a conversation saying how remote I felt from being able to help people like this, somehow serving in a rich and comfortable church in Marlow didn't feel like I was really helping people in need. But anyway, I waited, and early in 2016, I had a word from God. We do a 24/7 prayer event from time to time in Marlow, where we're encouraged just to go and pray quietly. And during this prayer time, a verse from Psalm 62 came to me, which was, "Let all that I am wait quietly before God, for my hope is in him." And so I waited. And during the rest of 2016, it was like I kept getting signposts towards refugees. There was a talk during Love Marlow, which was by somebody who'd been to volunteer on one of the islands. I went to a New Wine Women's Day, and there was somebody there talking about refugees. And I think my ears were just open, and I just kept picking up these little signals. But I waited. And I gradually put down my responsibilities at All Saints during that time. And then in September, so this is a year ago, September, my youngest daughter went off to university. And I thought, okay, this is an opportunity now, a bit more time, a bit more space. I connected with an old friend of mine called Tom, who I'd met at school. One of his daughters was the same age as mine, and we'd seen each other volunteering. I had found during that year that there was a group in High Wycombe who had started collecting aid, and I used that as an opportunity to go and volunteer, only a little bit, an hour here and there maybe, collect a few things from people in Marlow. And I'd spotted Tom there, and we hadn't really talked very much. But in September 2016, we had a conversation and said, why don't we do something in Marlow? We both had the same passion, and it just snowballed. Marlow, you may know, has a local radio station. We were invited to go and talk on the radio. We set up a Facebook group, and the response we got was just amazing. I have to say, it's been quite scary. It's not been easy. There are times like these when I think, God, is this really what I'm supposed to be doing? But I'm really proud of what we've done so far. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the group. So it's about a year since we set the group up. We've established we have three objectives. The first of those is raising awareness. So obviously talks like these. We have a newsletter. If you'd like to leave me with your email address, I'm very happy to share with you what we're doing. Events from time to time, which make it give more information, and of course we use social media channels as well. Our second objective is about raising money, and I'm going to come back and talk about that a little bit later on. And the third one is about collecting donations, and I know you already have been helping with our appeals and gathering things together. So I'll just talk a little bit about the donations for a while. So we're really lucky to have this established group in High Wycombe that's been up and running already. They'd been going for a year before we even started, and they had a lot of contacts with groups overseas and with shipping channels. So they'd already got an established sort of process, and we just hang on to their coattails and pick up on what they're appealing for and support that. We've had two events in Marlow where we encourage people to bring donations, and we sort and pack them, and I've brought with me, I'll get them out in a minute, some banana boxes. Discovered how wonderful banana boxes are. Those events are great because it's not like somebody's just dropping some stuff off. They come and they talk to people. We get a great community atmosphere and the conversations evolve. People learn more about what we're doing. We've got another one of those next weekend. So if you're interested and you want to come along and meet a few more people and find out, you know, a bit more about it, that's a great way to start. There's some leaflets at the back about that. And it felt like if we were coming together, we could achieve much more than just, you know, one or two people on their own. The things we collect are really carefully chosen to be those most in need. So at the moment, we're collecting winter coats and blankets, jumpers, and so on. There's always a need for toiletries, and we pack those up into little packs, a little kit, and new underwear. Can you imagine if you're living rough or in really basic conditions, how wonderful a gift of new underwear could be? We're also really careful about the routes we send the aid and where it goes to, and we always get pictures back of where it's being delivered and how it's being distributed. The group in High Wycombe that we're part of over the last 2 years has sent something like 20 containers now to various places, so a lot to Syria, some to Lebanon, to the refugee camps there, Greece and northern France, the places we've sent most often. And I do often ask myself, in the face of such a huge crisis, is what I'm doing worthwhile? And then I just have to, I get given perhaps a little coat, something like this, and I imagine it on the child the other end and think, wow, you know, that's just worth doing for that. And people knit us beautiful things. Just had a whole package of beautiful jumpers that somebody's knitted. So it feels like even though you do small things, that maybe together they make a difference. I want to just step back for a moment as well and just explain to you a bit about the crisis in total. I don't know about you may know all this, but when I started, I really wanted to understand the picture. Sue just talked about facts, actually, and how Jesus was clever and told stories. Actually, I quite like facts as well, so I did do a bit of investigation. Now, I was going to use my visual aids. Is it important that I stay by the microphone, though, for recording? It is. Okay. In that case, well, be my assistant if you like. Well, if you could pick up the box on the right first. That one. So these are our wonderful banana boxes that we use for packing aid and sending it. And I've got three banana boxes here in total. And these three banana boxes represent, if you can imagine it, the population of the UK, roughly. So here we are. 65 million people, so that's three banana boxes worth. That is the number of people who in 2016 were displaced from their homes because of war, terror, or persecution. So this is not people who are seeking better lives, who are economic migrants. These are people who are genuinely fleeing for their lives. It's a number that's the same as the population of our country. So of those 65 billion people, about 40, so about two-thirds, so that's two boxes worth, this one and the one I just picked up, 40 million are displaced from their homes, but they stay within their own country. So they've had to leave their home, and they've maybe gone to a town or a camp that is within their own country, but it's a safer place. Their home has maybe been destroyed. And you've all seen, I'm sure, all the pictures of Syria and how, you know, the towns there are just obliterated completely. And so a lot of people have had to leave their homes, but they've perhaps stayed within the borders of the country. The other third, so we've had two-thirds within their own country, and the other third, 22 million people, have chosen to flee across the border. So they've gone from their own country to somewhere, often quite close by. So if you take the Syria example, about half of the population of Syria is displaced, and about half of those have fled across borders, and they're in Turkey, in Lebanon, and in Jordan, in massive refugee camps. So in Lebanon, a quarter of the population of Lebanon is a refugee, most of which have come from Syria. The numbers are just extraordinary. And it's just like a really big problem you can't get your head round. There's one other fact, which is hidden down here somewhere, which is this little one at the bottom. It's 3 million, so that's the last number that makes up the 65. 3 million people are asylum seekers. So they have not just fled across the border, but they are seeking to make a permanent life somewhere else. They are applying for asylum, and those are the people that you see in the news quite a lot in terms of Europe, that they have come in the boats across from Turkey. They're applying to make a new life somewhere else. It's all very well talking about figures, but of course they're all individual people. They're people like you and I, and this is what really got to my heart in the end, was imagining my own family. These are professional people. They're accountants, lawyers, chefs, teachers, mothers, fathers, families, and for whatever reason, they've decided they cannot stay, they're not safe in their own home, and they're going to try and set up somewhere else. They don't want to face 10 years maybe living in a refugee camp, but actually they want to make a new life for themselves and start again. Those are the asylum seekers. And it's not in the news very much anymore. In the news recently, you've probably seen quite a lot about Myanmar, the Rohingya refugees, and they are people who have fled across the border. But a lot of the rest of the issues are not in the news at all, but it's still going on. So there are still, I think it's 100,000 people who have crossed the Mediterranean this year in these flimsy boats trying to get to either Greece or Italy. And there are still many people like little Alan Kurdi who have lost their lives in that crossing. It's all very well to talk about numbers, as I said, but of course they are people. And I was lucky enough to go to a refugee camp earlier this year, and I want to tell you a little bit about that too. So I went to an island called Samos, which is a Greek island just off the coast of Turkey. When you fly into Samos, you can look out of the plane window and you can see Turkey and the island of Samos, and they are really close by, so it's one of the very popular crossing points. It's also a popular holiday destination. I was on a plane that was actually full of tourists going to Samos on holiday. It's quite weird, really, and I was there going as a volunteer. And the holiday, you know, industry is still fine in Samos. But it's also home now to a refugee camp of about somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 people. It can actually accommodate officially about 800. It's like a concrete prison is the best way I can describe it. It's on the side of a hill just outside the main town of Vathy. They've made concrete levels. It's an old military camp originally. So there are concrete levels and there are containers on each of these levels. The whole camp is surrounded by razor wire, and it's managed by the Greek army, who are actually quite hostile. As I said, there's about room officially for about 800 or 900 people there, but of course people are arriving all the time. In September, this September just gone, another 900 people arrived on the island of Samos. So the camp is bursting at the seams and people are living in tents on the hillsides around. At the moment it's fine because it's dry, but of course quite soon the weather there changes and it becomes very rainy. And there's no infrastructure in the camp at all. They can't cook for themselves. The meals are provided by the Greek army in, they're sort of like ready meals, and frankly they're quite gross. So they can't cook, there's no activities there provided for them, there's no school for the children. Save the Children Fund were there for a while, but they are no longer there. And the welfare of these people, apart from those very basic needs of food, is taken care of by volunteers, grassroots volunteers. And I went there with a group called Samos Volunteers, about 20 or 30 people there. I was volunteering with volunteers from all over the world who go at their own cost, sometimes for many months and sometimes returning time after time. Of course, the refugees arrive on the island full of hope that their past, their horrors are behind them, and they're now about to step into a future that is safe and full of hope. Many of them attempt the crossing several times, but actually the reality of the camp and their uncertain future soon becomes very apparent. The conditions are poor and some do not leave for many months. The Greek system is just simply overwhelmed by the number of people applying for asylum, because that's what they have to do as soon as they reach Greece. Ever since the deal in Europe that they had to stay in the first country that they arrived and apply for asylum there. So they're sometimes stuck there for months. So the volunteer group offers an immediate welcome to all new arrivals, whatever time they arrive, and often it's the middle of the night. They provide a welcome pack of warm, dry clothes and some dry shoes, and they offer a friendly face and a warm smile. The group there also now offers a range of activities. They have a little centre in the town. The refugees are free to go in and out of the camp. They're not locked in the camp. They can go out into town, and the volunteer group has a centre, and they provide activities there to try and provide some sort of normality. So they do language classes, they do activities for ladies, craft activities, music, sports, and activities for the children too, sometimes school classes, but even just on a patch of earth outside the camp under a couple of olive trees while I was there, we would sit and play games with the children because, you know, there's no other, nothing for them to do really in the camp. These volunteers, they just blew me away, actually. It was the most extraordinary experience to be there with 25 or 30 people who, all different ages, all different nationalities, were all there with the same purpose in mind, to pour out love to these unfortunate people. Some of the refugees are also volunteers, usually if they've got really good language skills, and of course if they're held there for quite a long time, they want to get involved. And it's only a small picture, but these are four of the lovely people I met. There's a lady called Majida. She was a Palestinian refugee from Syria in her mid-20s. Jonathan from Burundi. Majd also came from Syria. And Manib here was from Afghanistan. And they all had their own stories of pain and fear and loss. And yet I saw in them the same qualities as I see in my own children. Of course, I came back with a passion to try and do more. And that brings me back to fundraising, which was the third of our objectives. Because actually, sending goods is one thing, but actually funds are so much more useful. Because for one thing, they can buy exactly what they need. They can also buy it in the country, so it supports the local economy. And if you know anything about Greece, they're also in a financial mess as well. So actually money in Greece is actually far more useful than donations. We're not going to stop collecting donations, but we do realise that fundraising is really important. And we do have a current appeal as well, of course, which is also on the leaflet. But what's great is to be able to raise money for a group of people that you know, and you know what they're going to be doing with the money, and you know that 100% of that money is going to go towards what they're going to do with it. When I came back from Samos, we raised about £3,000. £2,000 of that they spent on the new arrival kits for new people, and the other £1,000 went towards some laptops to use for IT classes in their teaching centre. Just coming back to my own journey a little bit, I told you earlier on that during my waiting time I had many signposts from God. One of those signposts was a preacher who came to give a talk at our church in All Saints. He's a man by the name of Simon Gilbo. He was a missionary from Burundi. And his talk is available on our YouTube channel, actually. So if you want to listen to something, it's really worth, I could recommend listening to it. But he came with a real message of challenge, as he put it, to the comfortable people of Marlow, to really shake us out of our apathy and realise how lucky we were, and to realise what God might be asking for of us. And it brings me back to the reading that we heard earlier, who is our neighbour, and what or can we or should we be doing to help. I live in a beautiful town, and we all live in a beautiful area, and our lives are by and large safe and comfortable. I believe God is calling me, and perhaps us, to respond to that challenge that Simon came to give. This past year has been a great and unexpected adventure that I've been on. It's certainly not what I thought I would be doing this last year, but every time I've faced obstacles, or lost my way, or been overcome by fear, like when I was on the plane to Samos, God has been faithful to me, and he's supported me, and provided help and encouragement in the most extraordinary ways. And actually, you're part of the story, because whenever I kind of feel a little bit down or disconnected, I find that somebody else comes alongside me, and I got a message from the people in Freith to say, "Oh, we've heard you're collecting something. Can we do something to help, maybe?" And you just think, yes, God's got this all sorted, actually. He's just supporting me and encouraging me when I need it. And I've been learning more and more to trust in him, actually, and try not to limit my vision to what I can think of, but actually what God is capable of is so much more. So I'm trying to actually just let go and see where it's going to take me. I'm just going to read you a little. This is a book by Simon Gilbo that I bought after he came and gave us a talk, and it was a book of readings, and you know, it just often was the right reading the right day. The reading when I left to go to Samos, the morning I left, or the morning before perhaps, I think I was a bit too busy on the actual morning, but the little prayer at the end of it said, "Lord, I don't see the road ahead, I assume you do. So I choose to trust you in everything, leaning my whole weight upon you today." So this was a great help, but also a challenge. And I've just picked one little bit out of here, which is that, you know, we can't respond to every need. This is my cause. It may not be yours. A lot of you may be involved in charity already. But he suggests, ask God what he wants you to get involved in. You can't respond to every need, but you can pick one person, one place, one issue in your area or across the oceans. Let it get under your skin, break your heart, make you weep, and decide to stay. I think we're going to just think about now what that means for us.